Hi everyone, my name is Dina Miller. I'm the events coordinator for YU Medical Ethics Society. Welcome to today's breakout session on the Nuremberg Laws and Code in Light of the 21st Century Medical Ethics presented by Dr. Harry Oster. Dr. Oster is professor of pathology, genetics, and pediatrics in Albert Einstein College of Medicine and director of genetic and genomic testing at Montefiore Medical Center. A graduate from MIT in 1972, Dr. Oster received his MD from Columbia University and received his training in pediatrics and medical genetics at Johns Hopkins University and in molecular genetics at the National Institute of Health. Dr. Oster investigates the genetic basis of common and rare disorders and, in a diagnostic laboratory, translates the findings into practical interpretations. He is a longtime investigator of the genetics of the Jewish people, most recently through the Jewish HapMap project, an international effort to map and sequence the genomes of Jewish people. He explores the significance of a biological basis for Jewishness on individual and group identity in his book Legacy, A Genetic History on the Jewish People. Without further ado, Dr. Oster.
So thank you all very much for coming to this session today. At lunchtime, Nisan Hershkowitz, a physician whom I've actually gotten to know this week on the basis of another talk, said to me, you know, in terms of what you're going to be talking about, how is this different from Nazi eugenics? And so he forced me in the last half hour to crystallize what I think the differences are. The first is that I think that modern medical and population genetics are real sciences, not pseudosciences. My partner and I here were just talking about, gee, there was this precision in Nazi physics and chemistry, but truly lacking in medical research. You know, you use the term slipshod. I think that is true. The lack of accuracy in prediction were certainly important in characterizing observations about genetics and its, you know, its evil twin, eugenics, as a pseudoscience rather than as a real science. The second feature about contemporary genetics is that it's non-judgmental. It doesn't make determinations about the relative value of people, whereas Nazi race science clearly had a hierarchy in terms of Nordics and Alpines and Mediterraneans and, of course, Jews and blacks at the bottom of the hierarchy, along with homosexuals and mental defectors. And the third feature about contemporary medical genetics is that it truly intends to be benevolent and not malevolent. So it means to help people, it means to benefit people, and it means not only to benefit people, but also not to harm people. And so I think indeed that we have come a long way since the middle of the 20th century. So I'm going to frame this in the context of Jewish identity because certainly there was an effort on the part of the Nazis, and for that matter among the Jews themselves, to define who Jews were. And even Albert Einstein, for whom our medical school is named, wondered who the Jews were. In 1921, the Berlin rabbis invited Einstein to join a shul, but he didn't want to. So he wrote back to them and said that, I noticed that the word Jew is ambiguous in that it refers to nationality and origin and to faith. I am a Jew in the first sense and not the second. But on the other hand, Einstein went on to say that his relationship with the Jewish people was the closest, that he had. He, for instance, was offered the presidency of Israel, which he declined. And he truly took pride in his Jewishness. He said, for instance, in his philosophical tract in 1931, "The World as I See It," the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake, an almost fanatical love of justice, and the desire for personal independence, these are the features of the Jewish tradition which make me thank my stars that I belong to. So we see here, you know, three different definitions of Jewishness. You know, one is a religion, the second is a nationality. You know, these are people who lived together once upon a time in a nation state. And the third is culture. But there are also physical features about the Jewish, which the Jewish physical anthropologists, Maurice Fishberg and Joseph Jacobs, among others, tried to grapple with. So in his paper and subsequently his book about the same name, The Jews, the Study of Race and Environment, Fishberg said, one can pick out a Jew from among a thousand non-Jews without difficulty. I think many Jews feel the same way today. I see people in the audience nodding here. So they must agree with Fishberg in that regard. And Jacobs amplified this point in saying the remarkable unity of resemblance among Jews, even in different climes, seems to imply a common descent. So Jacobs carried it beyond, you know, physical resemblance and looked for a hereditary basis for Jewishness. He, for instance, had become familiar with Mendel's work, which had been rediscovered in 1901, and Jacobs suggested, for instance, that there was a gene for Jewishness and that it was a Mendelizing trait. In the Jewish HapMap project, we've argued, well, it's not a single gene, it's a whole series of threads that link the Jewish people together. And I'll show you another genetic definition of Jewishness in just a minute. And this point of view about resemblance, and certainly the Germans and other non-Jewish Europeans commented about this during the 19th and 20th centuries, and yet Jews remain, at least to most other Jews, and the Europeans would have said anti-Europeans, identifiably, unmistakably Jewish. So there was an effort to make race science into something that was quantitative. Fishberg and his compatriots used calipers to measure head width and length, and to plot the ratio, and to come up with an estimate of the shape. And so Fishberg, for instance, in this monograph that was published in 1902, published data on 500 male Jews and 215 female Jews. You can see the archaic term that is being used there. And he came to the determination that, you know, you could judge Jews by their round-headedness. You know, he, for instance, wrote a lot about the shape of the Jewish nose in his book, The Jews, the Study of Race and Environment, as well. But these were relatively imprecise terms that were describing this gestalt of Jewishness that many people felt that they could recognize. So in 2009, David Goldstein and Anna Mead published this paper in Genome Biology. And they tell you the punchline up front. Here we show that within Americans of European ancestry, there is a perfect genetic correlate of Jewish ancestry, which in principle would permit near-perfect genetic inference of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. So we know who you are from testing your genome. And we know, in fact, how Jewish you are from testing your genome. Here are people with four Jewish grandparents, three, two, and one. And so on the basis of admixture that is occurring, this sort of principal component cluster plot that you see here shows the ancestry of the people, you know, shifting from, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish to European. Now, this isn't an observation that is unique to Need and Goldstein. You know, we found it in the Jewish Half Project as well. We didn't feel quite the need to advertise it in the same way that they did. And frankly, the observation really antedated them. Others who were working in the field of genetic epidemiology in the United States noticed that when they studied their European American populations, that there were really two different groups. And for instance, in 2004, I was at Harvard Medical School and I had a meeting with David Reich and his associates, and they said, you know, gee, we think that we see these two different groups. Do you think one of them could be Ashkenazi Jewish? You know, they come from the Boston suburbs, and the proportion, you know, is about what one would predict for their being Ashkenazi Jewish. And of course, they were. So all of this gets tempered in light of the Nuremberg experience. And there are really two different Nuremberg experiences. And I understand that you've heard about these today. There was a party congress that was taking place in 1935, and Hitler wanted to make a splash. And my understanding is that originally he wanted to support the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, but he decided instead that he would put the focus on the meeting of the German parliament in Nuremberg for the first time in 500 years. And while they were there, they passed a couple of laws, one of which is the Nuremberg Law for the protection of German blood and German honor. And they were very frank about their intent. They said, for instance, in Section 1, marriages between Jews and citizens of German or kindred blood are forbidden. Marriages concluded in defiance of the law are void, even for the purpose of evading the law. They were concluded abroad. Extramarital sexual intercourse between Jews and subjects of the state of Germany or related blood is forbidden. So, you know, they're clearly staking out that Jews aren't, you know, Jews aren't Germans. You know, Jews are Jews and Germans are Germans, and the two should mix. Jews weren't allowed to employ female Germans under the age of 45 as domestic workers. What I must say I found particularly perverse in this was that they said, you know, Jews can't display the Reich or the national flag or the national colors, not that they necessarily would have wanted to, but they were permitted nonetheless to display the Jewish culture. Jewish colors. And then in the second part about this, they talk about the institution and the promulgation and the penalties that are associated with the Nuremberg Law for the protection of German blood and German honor. But of course, there's a need also to define who a Jew is. You know, it's all well and good to say, you know, Jews are different and they're not allowed to mix with Germans and employ Germans, but in the Law on Citizenship and Race of 1935, they were very specific. A Jew is an individual who is descended from at least three grandparents who were racially full Jews. A Jew is also an individual who is descended from two full Jewish grandparents if he was a member of the Jewish religious community when this law was issued or joined the community later. When the law was issued, he was married to a person who was a Jew or was subsequently married to a Jew. And so, as we know, you know, the Germans were very specific about who was Jewish and who was going to experience the discrimination and ultimately the extermination policies of the Third Reich. And, you know, for some people, you know, for everyone this was clearly tragic, but for some people it was tragic in the sense that they didn't even realize that they were Jewish because of the type of assimilation that took place in the 20th century. So this journal by Alain Baer was published a couple of years ago. As you can see, it was written in 1941. And she has been referred to as the French Anne Frank. Her journal survived her. And she wrote, when I write the word Jew, I'm not saying exactly what I mean, because for me this distinction does not exist. I do not feel different from other people. I will never think of myself as a member of a separate human group. And perhaps that is why I suffer so much, because I don't understand it at all. So after the war, there were, of course, a series of trials. As you know, I must confess that in preparation for this, my family and I watched the movie Judgment of Nuremberg, which I had seen previously, but I would certainly commend to you if you haven't seen. I did do more preparation also than just watching movies. Right. But it has, you know, it has a wonderful cast in it as well. William Holden and Maximilian Schell and Judy Garland and Marlene Dietrich. It's really one of the great movies. But it sort of compresses what were many different trials into one trial, and it led to really a series of codes. So on the one hand, the concept of crimes against humanity were created in the first set of political trials that took place in Nuremberg. And then there were trials against physicians as well. And this led to the Nuremberg Code of 1947, which really governs a lot of our thinking about how to do research and, frankly, how to practice genetic medicine today. So, you know, you're familiar with all of these because you've heard about them, and undoubtedly everyone here has signed some sort of consent form that has noted, for instance, that the voluntary consent of human subjects is absolutely essential. Experiments should be such as to yield fruitful results for the good of society, unprocurable by other means of study, and not random and unnecessary in nature. So here is the benevolence in human research. The experiment should be designed based on the results of animal experimentation and a knowledge of the natural history of disease, so it should be thoughtful and informed. The experiment should be conducted so as to avoid unnecessary physical, mental suffering and injury. So it should not be malevolent, as I said at the beginning. And it certainly shouldn't be conducted in such a way that it will cause death or disabling injury to people. Here are more features of the Nuremberg Code as well. And it tended to inform the informed consent movement. It tended to inform informed consent in the United States and also in Europe. This was followed sometime later by a Helsinki convention. And in most European countries and in Israel, when people talk about institutional review boards, medical ethics committees, and informed consent, they talk about having a Helsinki committee, which represents this deliberate sort of approach to how to go about performing human experimentation. But it's also been carried over into the practice of medical genetics as well. And so here is the informed consent law for New York State that was passed in 1997. And it deals with the confidentiality of records of genetics, of genetic tests. It provides a series of definitions about what a genetic test means. It's interesting because it was very carefully parsed. And I know this in a very personal way because I worked on this law at the time. So here's a definition of a genetic test. Here is a definition of a genetic predisposition. So it shall mean the presence of variation in the composition of genes of an individual, which is determined to be associated with an increased statistical risk of being expressed either as a physical or mental disease. But it points out that there are some really important features here that really go back to the Nuremberg Code of 1947. No person shall perform a genetic test on a biological sample taken from an individual without prior written informed consent of such individual. So you know, here's the concept of informed consent from Nuremberg being carried forward into the 21st century. And it says there can't be a general waiver of informed consent. And the law goes into rather exquisite detail about what the features of informed consent should be. So it can't, it is not intended to be simply a matter of, oh, we're planning to do a little blood test on you, now can you sign on the line here. Requires spelling out all of those elements about what the test is, what its significance is, and what the likelihood of getting a positive or negative result and what those might be. Now, it doesn't cover, as you can see, ancestry testing. The law, which is a model for laws in other states as well, refers specifically to genetic diseases and genetic predispositions. And so at the same time, we have a direct-to-consumer movement that many people in the United States are participating in to learn more about their ancestry. So here's an ad from one company which says, "Discover your Jewish ancestry. Our Jewish comparative databases are the largest in the world." So you can determine how many segments you share with other Jewish people, and you can add them up, and you can decide which of those different columns that you saw on the previous board you might fall into. You could determine, for instance, how related you are to Harry Oscar if he chose to make his data public. Which I haven't. I think that there are some important caveats with do-it-yourself genetic testing. You know, you can look at your paternal line and see, you know, is there a co-anemia modal haplotype there? You know, is there evidence of one of the four so-called founding mothers of Ashkenazi Jewry? These aren't Rachel, Sarah, you know, Rivka, and Leah. They're a different set of founding mothers in Ashkenazi Jewry, but you know, it's all knowable. But in the process, you can also look at your individual segments of DNA. And Nuremberg, you know, the Nuremberg Code really hasn't gotten here quite yet. And it is somewhat troubling to me because there is the prospect of adding people. So in the process of doing this, you can look to see, well, you know, is my shared segment that carries my high risk of breast cancer on the basis of a mutation in the BRCA1 gene shared by other people who are in this database? And oh, by the way, you know, Shirley Shapiro, you know, you didn't know this before, but you know, we're related to each other as fourth cousins, and we share this BRCA1 segment that puts you at risk for breast cancer. Now, Mrs. Shapiro should have had the opportunity to decide for herself with the sort of autonomy that is implied in the New York State and other laws to decide, well, you know, do I want to know that? You know, am I prepared to know that? And if so, you know, how might I use that information? And do I necessarily want strangers to know that factor about me? And it's a very real sort of thing, because what we have come to learn from studying the population genetics of various Jewish groups is that there is a high degree of relatedness that occurs within these Jewish groups. The degree of relatedness between any two Ashkenazi Jews is what one would observe for fourth to fifth cousins, and for Iranian Jews, third cousins, for Libyan Jews, first cousins once removed. So there is a lot of prospect for learning about other people's genomes if they make their data public and identifiable. So last year, Carl Sorecki and I put on a conference in Israel which celebrated a 50th anniversary for a conference that Chaim Sheba had put on in 1961. And that conference was called The Genetics of Migrant and Isolate Populations. And it was the first major international population genetics conference. It was predominantly about Jews, but it was about other isolate and migrant populations as well. And it involved the major genetic luminaries of mid-20th century. For instance, J.B.S. Haldane, who was a great luminary in population genetics, was the honorary president of the conference. But we thought it would be good to see where we've come in the last 50 years. So the first day and a half was comprised of a scientific conference. And then the last half day was a public discussion in Hebrew about the genetics of being Jewish. And there were two different sessions, as you can see here, the genetics of personal Jewish identity, which we'll talk about, and the second one about genetic predeterminism and personal responsibility. Had a quite a notable panel. Aaron Chicanor is a faculty member at the Technion and won the Nobel Prize. Mary Claire King is president of the American Society of Human Genetics. Dan Margolyte is a journalist. Meir Shatrit is a member of Knesset. Yuval Sherlo is a rabbi and a halachic expert in Israel. And Alan Templeton is a geneticist. And we looked at some of the issues in genetics as they relate to Israeli law. And so there are several that are important. One is the law of return, which enables Jews to return to Israel. You're all obviously familiar with that. The second is the nationality law, which, as you can see, has been amended multiple times. Gaining citizenship in Israel is different from being able to migrate to Israel. And then there is the much debated Israeli practice for governing marriage for Jews. And David Ben-Gurion wrote a letter about maintaining the status quo, which has been maintained ever since the decision about issuing a marriage license is not determined by the state. It is determined by the rabbinical authority. And as you can see, Ben-Gurion anticipated that this was going to be a weighty matter of integrity of religion. And the concern was to prevent a division of the House of Israel into two. And given the contentiousness about this issue today, some of you might argue, well, that is happening anyway. The Law of Return grants every Jew, whether wherever he or she may be, the right to come to Israel as an Oleh and become an Israeli citizen. It proposes that a Jew means a person who is born of a Jewish mother, is converted to Judaism, and is not a member of another religion. And it spells out in a rather exquisite detail who an Oleh might be. And the Law of Return really has the German Nuremberg Laws of 1935 in mind when it was written, because the sense was, well, you know, people who might be victims of Nazism, you know, should be the ones who should be able to gain immigration status within Israel. And so the Nuremberg Laws, for instance, have been amended, and this law has been amended so that even the non-Jewish spouses of Jews have the opportunity of becoming an Oleh, as, for instance, is shown in this amendment that is here. So genetics has the possibility then of transforming the decision about who is a Jew, as you've seen. And so Karl Skorecki wrote this case, which we presented to the panel. And I thought we might spend a little bit of time talking about this. I should say that this created enormous backflips in ways that you wouldn't have imagined when the case was presented there, with a lot of the geneticists saying, well, this was never the intent of how genetic information might be used. But let's talk about how this information might be used. So it says, it is 2011 and a 28-year-old woman plans to marry an Israeli man in Israel. The woman immigrated at age 12 from Ukraine under the Law of Return. There is documentation of Jewish identity for her paternal grandfather, but no comparable record on her maternal side. The woman decides on her own to carry out private genetic testing, which shows that her mitochondrial maternally transmitted DNA is K1A1B1A sublineage. So this is one of the Jewish, you know, one of the Ashkenazi Jewish founder mothers, which is shared by 1.5 million Jews and virtually absent in non-Jews. So the question is, scientifically, legally, and socially, should she be eligible for Jewish identity based on marriage in Israel without the need for conversion? So what do you all think? Yes, ma'am?
Although I'm sure it doesn't sound good, I don't think she is eligible. There's a law defining who a Jew is, and it doesn't address DNA.
So should the law be amended, as, for instance, the law, as the Law of Return has been amended?
From an Orthodox point of view, I don't think so. I'm just looking as an individual, obviously, but I don't think so.
So her K1A1B1A, you know, is very likely to have come from a Jewish mother who didn't self-identify. So the question is, you know, is it required that her mother self-identify as Jewish, or was her mother Jewish anyway? As identified by her mitochondrial type. So she didn't, you know, she just didn't know. She didn't know better.
Could you clarify a little bit the science of this? So if you have a Jewish mother somewhere, no matter how many generations back, the mitochondrial
doesn't change.
Change.
So right, we can turn around. So right, it gets transmitted through the tree. You know, it starts out on this particular branch, and you know, mitochondria are these energy-producing organelles that are present in all of the cells in our body. They have their own genetic material that originates in egg cells. So the egg cells come from the mother, and there's no paternal contribution, so it really looks at the maternal lineage you know, from one generation to the next, in the same way that the Y chromosomal lineages are transmitted from father to son, you know, over multiple generations.
And also, do other ethnic groups that say are a little bit larger, but so for example, are all blacks genetically, belong to the same genetic family? Would it have to do with different parts of Africa that they?
Let's not really go there, because that's a much more complicated subject. On the one hand, there's far greater genetic diversity in Africa, and for African Americans, of course, they were mixed with Europeans and Native Americans, so it creates far more complexity than maybe we want to get into. It is important, from the point of view of racism, and so making simple-minded statements about Africans or African Americans are probably unwarranted. When James Watson, for instance, makes a statement about the future prospects for Africans being dim, which Africans is he talking about? There's more genetic diversity in Africa than there is in the rest of the world combined. So, but let's not go there. Let's stick with this example.
Just for the conversation, I understand your point that maybe we shouldn't be introducing genetics at all, and halacha should be halacha, but halacha is not as orthodox as one thinks. So the Gemara tells us that we're not allowed to do a circumcision on a person that three people in that family have bled to death. Yet now in the availability of factor 8, that you can into a hemophiliac, we do circumcision. Halacha tells us that a person who is deaf is not allowed to do certain mitzvot, not allowed to serve as a shohet tzibur. And now with cochlear implants and the ability to speak, things have changed. So not unreasonable to think of amen.
But do you have examples that are non-medically related?
The science of medicine has changed, and therefore the health has changed.
Yeah. It would seem that our concern is more about attestation and a claim made by the entering individual. The law as written is being crafted for the purposes of I identify with this, but that's what's left when you have no screening to be able to do to ascertain where somebody is from. When you have rock solid data to be able to call upon, it would seem a no-brainer to then try to establish that material rather than just somebody's bald assertion when they come through a naturalization office and say, I'm Jewish.
So for instance, in the law today, we use forensic testing a lot to say, this tissue sample, be it blood or semen or, other tissue was derived from that particular individual, and we say the level of certainty for this is extremely high. In the American court system, in Western court systems, in the Israeli court system, genetic testing is used as a standard for identity. So if it is used as a standard for identity in criminal law, should religious law be so far behind?
I think we actually have a case with 9/11. DNA was used a lot to identify who really died, so that from a halachic point of view, the women wouldn't be up and out. So halacha has used DNA a lot already, and so we have a precedent.
We certainly do. There are people in the back who wanted to say stuff.
Yeah. You can reverse the argument. That is that, take for example, surrogacy, surrogate mother. It's the birth mother that determines the characteristics of the child, social characteristics. So, in most cases, if a child were born to a Jewish mother, and say the egg came from a non-Jewish mother, the child by definition would be Jewish, even though they would probably go through a form of conversion as well. So that's reversing the
Right. And so your point is very well taken with regard to the accuracy of the test. And the testing app can really be made, you know, quite accurate. And that has certainly been, you know, a problem with genetic testing all along the way. It was a problem with forensic genetic testing in its early days, but then it improved. And so now it really does tend to withstand scrutiny. It was a problem with the covalent model haplotype as it was originally reported, but that has improved. And in the case of mitochondrial testing, you know, it has also improved. And so, yes, it's possible to say, you know, this is found in this cohort of Jewish women. It's found predominantly, Jewish people, since, of course, it goes to sons as well as daughters. The issue, of course, is Jewish people married outside the faith and their children, you know, were then lost to the religion. So, you know, we've shown in our work, others have shown in their work, that you know, markers of Jewishness are observable among, you know, non-Jewish people who have Jewish ancestors. So is that a plausible exception for this? Or does it negate the validity of the observation?
I have a basic question that I don't understand something. Someone's father has an X and a Y. So the mitochondrial DNA is in that father also?
Right? No, he has the mitochondrial type that he got from his mother.
Right, his mother.
Right. He doesn't transmit it to his children. Only his wife transmits her mitochondrial type to
for further clarification, if there's someone whose great-great-great-grandmother was Jewish, this great-great-great-granddaughter will have that mitochondrial DNA? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
What about the Ethiopians in Israel who claim to be from the ancient tribes?
Right. Let's put it this way. It's not immediately germane to this argument, but let's put it this way. You know, they are, you know, recognized as being, you know, Jewish in Israel, and you know, their history is such that there were probably relatively few Judean converts, you know, who went to Ethiopia and converted local people to Jewishness. But proselytism was common during the time of classical antiquity, and you know, it happened throughout the, you know, the Mediterranean basin at that time. And so most Jews have, you know, hybrid ancestry, but that sort of goes, you know, past what we're trying to talk about right here. I talk about that a lot in my book Legacy. The fact is that Fishberg's argument can now be substantiated with a fair degree of accuracy. You know, one can pick out a Jew from among 1,000 non-Jews with certainty. By doing a genetic test, not just by looking at them. You know, I might look at you and still, you know, walk away wondering, but, you know, I could do a genetic test and have absolutely no doubts whatsoever.
Was it done in the Ethiopian community?
I'm sorry?
Was it done in the Ethiopian community or Israel?
Or
it's not
so
right.
Difficult?
Yes.
Right.
I wanted to answer the question. Yes, it depends whether you're talking science, legal, and law. So I'm wondering if certainly you might combine the scientific and the legal. I not being right, I don't know how the halal could fit in. But suppose we could use the standard that scientifically that suggests the marker of being Jewish, but you wouldn't impose that on a person. The person said, I don't want to identify. Conversely,
of course,
you would say, there is a Jewish marker, and if you want to identify Jewishly, then that would qualify you legally.
Sure. That would obviously require a change of practice within Israel. It was very interesting in terms of this discussion that the geneticists were all horrified by this and said it was never the intent of genetics. Genetics was learning about traits, not about religious identities. And these were Israeli geneticists who were talking with great passion. The rabbis who were there saying, gee, this is kind of interesting. We're kind of like babies with this, but we should be thinking about this, more seriously, because this gives us a new tool, that's objective. And if it has this level of certainty, then maybe it is something that we should, consider adopting in our deliberations. I see we only have a minute or two left, but with the work that we've done, there have been some unfortunate comments that have been made along the way. So, for instance, when Dr. Burns and I published a paper in 2010 from the Jewish HapMap Project, Shlomo Sand, the Israeli historian who published a book called The Invention of Jewishness, was quite critical of the work. He's a post-Zionist Israeli who has a particular point of view about the Jewish state, but he made a really outrageous statement, which is Hitler would have been proud. And
of calling original or not calling original,
why? Would have been proud of the fact that it's now possible to do what the Nuremberg Laws laid out with the German precision of the 1930s, well, the American and Israeli precision of the 2000s, it is that much greater, and it really is possible to know, pick out a Jew from among 1,000 non-Jews without difficulty. So, is that a beneficial thing? Is that a malevolent thing? I would argue that we live in a very different time, and of course.